KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. In just a few minutes, Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, a representative on Ames City Council, will be on air for her monthly visit. Then later in the show, we'll be calling Rose Green in Des Moines, who is with an organization called Parents for Great Iowa Schools, and she will be talking with us about what is going on in the legislative session related to schools in Iowa. And Lucia Suarez, an associate professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at ISU, will be here to tell about her vision for the U.S. Latino-Latina Studies Program. Well, yesterday was April 1st, so that means it was April Fool's Day. Hopefully you weren't fooled too much, too many pranks pulled on you. I hope folks enjoyed the weekend and the Easter holiday for those who celebrated it. But it did not feel very Easter-like or even spring-like yesterday. But one sign of spring is the Decorah Eagles hatching, and we're going to have an update on that in a minute. And at least we did not wake up to a snowfall on Saturday morning as we did the previous two Saturdays. For the coming week, let's see what the weather has in store. Today, there will be sun and clouds with a high of 43, but then the rest of the week will be colder again with temperatures in the 30s most days. The only exception is Wednesday, when it will reach the 40s. And as of now, the prediction is for mixed precipitation on Tuesday and flurries, light snow, and then more mixed precipitation on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Still doesn't sound like spring weather, but at least the days are getting longer. Here is a summary of local Iowa news as well as Iowa in the national news during the past week, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand issued a court injunction against the town of Sibley, ordering the town to no longer threaten legal action against a 28-year-old resident. The resident, Joshua Harms, published a website called Should You Move to Sibley, Iowa, that criticized the town for smelling, quote, like rancid dog food because of odors from the Iowa drying and processing manufacturing plant. Last year, Sibley officials sent Joshua Harms a cease and desist letter telling him that his website was hurting business in the town and that if he did not take it down within 10 days, he would be sued. Instead, with the help of the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa, Harms sued the town. Adding another twist, in February, the owner of the manufacturing plant also sued the town, claiming that an odor ordinance it had repeatedly enforced against the plant had cost them millions of dollars, made it more difficult to sell the plant, and was illegally vague and arbitrary. Also related to the ACLU of Iowa, they are hosting an event called Know Your Rights Student Edition at the Ames Public Library on Wednesday, April 11th at 6 p.m. On Friday, District Court Judge David May threw out a lawsuit filed by Larry Headland, a former agent with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Headland was fired in 2013, shortly after he reported that the SUV used by then-Governor Terry Branstad and his Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds routinely violated traffic laws by speeding. Headland sued the state and Governor Branstad specifically, alleging wrongful termination, which is a whistleblower protection violation, and defamation. Branstad had cited moral issues as the reason for Headland's termination during a 2013 press conference. The judge dismissed the lawsuit, saying Branstad could not have defamed him for speaking about matters of general interest to the public. An attorney for Headland told the Des Moines Register that they plan to appeal the ruling to the Iowa Supreme Court. The Iowa Democratic Party filed a public records request Wednesday for more information about Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' termination of Iowa Finance Authority Director Dave Jamieson over sexual harassment claims. A spokesperson for Reynolds announced in late March that Jamieson had been fired after the governor's office was made aware of, quote, credible allegations of sexual harassment, unquote, the previous evening. But the governor's office has not elaborated further. The Democratic Party, the Iowa Democratic Party, has requested Jamieson's hiring records and personnel file, emails from the governor's office and the Iowa Finance Authority regarding harassment and Jamieson's termination, and Reynolds' schedules, call logs, and emails for the day before and of his termination. Jamieson is a former Story County treasurer and had had close ties to Reynolds in the past. Jamieson's firing came in the wake of the Iowa GOP's sexual harassment case that resulted in a $1.75 million taxpayer-funded settlement for Kirsten Anderson, a former communications director in the Republican State Senate office. The Wall Street Journal reported last week that the health insurance bill likely to be signed by Governor Kim Reynolds will become the latest test of the ability of states to allow coverage that does not comply with the federal Affordable Care Act. The legislation would allow the Iowa Farm Bureau to partner with Wellmark Blue Cross and Blue Shield to sell health insurance coverage to its members. Iowa Democrats, including Senator Joe Balcom of Iowa City, have criticized the bill. Under this legislation, policies offered by Wellmark could offer relatively low premiums for young and healthy consumers, but people with pre-existing health problems could once again be charged more or denied coverage. Critics argue that the bill would undermine consumer protections. Last Tuesday, the Iowa Department of Public Health offered licenses to three companies, allowing them to open medical cannabidiol dispensaries in five cities across the state. The companies are MedPharma Iowa, which was given licenses to operate in Sioux City and the Des Moines suburb of Windsor Heights, Have a Heart Compassion Care in Council Bluffs and Davenport, and Iowa Cannabis Company in Waterloo. MedPharm Iowa, whose parent company is based in Colorado, where marijuana is legal, is the only company in Iowa with a license to manufacture cannabis oil here. Although Iowa's system is routinely referred to as a medical marijuana program, cannabidiol is a non-psychoactive part of the cannabis plant. Recreational marijuana itself still remains fully illegal in the state of Iowa. And that is a summary of local Iowa news as well as Iowa in the national news. For more information on these and other stories, go to iowainformer.com. And as promised, we also have an update from Pat Schlarbaum on the hatching of the Decorah Eagles.
Yes, for the 12th year, the Decorah Eagles have successfully incubated the first egg, first of three, that was hatched yesterday morning. And the update for today is it should be joined by its second sibling later today. And then there's a third egg that will hopefully hatch Tuesday or Wednesday. So it's nature's moving along, sure sign of spring. And the Decorah Eagles can be viewed on their website, Raptor Resource Project, Decorah Eagles. And it's just a wondrous day. And if you go to that website, you can hear all the birds of spring, and it's kind of delightful.
Definitely wondrous to see them. Thanks for the update, Pat.
stands upon the traces.
That was Anushka Shankar and Nora Jones performing Traces of You. People may not know that those two women are half-sisters, and their father was Ravi Shankar. And now we've been joined by Bronwyn Beatty Hansen in the studio. And Bronwyn is the at-large representative on the Ames City Council. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And this is your monthly segment. Today we're going to focus on, I think you called it City Council 101.
Yeah, exactly. In prior months, I've gone over, you know, what's coming up in the month and what we've done. And I'll do that to a certain extent a little bit later. But I thought first, just sort of an educational lesson on how City Council operates and also how citizens can bring topics to the council, because that's a common question.
Great. I think people need to know that, or it helps to know that.
Yeah, exactly. So first, I thought I'd cover the structure of our meetings. City Council meetings start usually at 6 p.m. We have them on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month. And then some additional Tuesdays, we do special workshops in addition, also typically 6 p.m. But the regular council meetings start with a series of proclamations. And then we have our consent agenda, which is, items on the agenda that aren't expected to be controversial. Sometimes we might pull an item off of the consent agenda just to talk about it or highlight it, or sometimes there is discussion about those items, and so we pull them. But for the most part, those go quickly.
And are things that are voted on at that time by council, or no?
Yeah, we vote on them all as a group.
Okay.
So anything on the consent agenda, unless an item is pulled for further discussion, all those items get passed at once.
Okay.
Just to speed things up. And often there are, 30 items on the consent agenda, so thankfully,
okay,
we don't discuss each one at a time. And then after the consent agenda, we have a public forum. This is a time for people to speak about something that's not on the agenda. If they have an item they're interested in that's on the agenda, that they wait until that particular item is up for discussion. But public forum is where they can bring suggestions to us that aren't there normally. And so people can bring up comments in public forum, and then we move on to the rest of our meeting, the staff reports on various topics, motions, resolutions, and hearings, things like that.
Do people have to sign up in advance to speak at the public forum?
Ah, good question. If you want to speak at City Council, there are little orange cards you fill out with your name and your topic, and you hand those in for record keeping. Also, to get up and speak, you have to say your name and your address,
mm-hmm,
which folks who are new to City Council might not know. But really, the mayor will ask if anyone wants to speak at public forum, and someone could raise their hand or, indicate that they'd like to speak then. And then they can always fill out a card after the fact, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have
to
pre-register necessarily. So then after the meeting then, after the things we vote on regularly, like resolutions and hearings and things like that, then we have a section of the meeting called Council Comments. And that is a time for making announcements, maybe about upcoming events or topics we're interested in. But it's also the time that we refer any new items to staff. So if someone does have something at public forum, say they have a law or an ordinance they'd like to see changed or something, and that's their suggestion at public forum, in council comments, that'd be the time for us to bring it up and have staff report back about it. And that's actually new this year, in a sense. Prior councils have handled communications like that differently over time. I think there's no legal requirement on how you handle a communication that comes into you. So if someone sends us all an email or a letter or comes to speak at public forum, that would all be the same in the sense that, you're sending all of us a communication, whether it's written or verbal. We can either bring that up for further discussion or not. But this council has decided that it's polite at least to give some answer, whether that answer is yes or no. And so we have been in the habit of adding there's a new section in the council meetings called Dispositions of Council Toward Communications. And the purpose of that section is to go over any communications we've received, whether email or verbal, and make sure we've gotten memos from staff if we need them for more information or anything like that, or if we don't want to bring that item up or if we're not interested in pursuing it, to at least say to the person who suggested it, well, we can't do that at this time. I mean, we have priorities as a city, and we really we do have to decide what we want to focus our time on. So
if I'm hearing you correctly, when people make a comment during the public comment period at a meeting, or if they send the council members an email about a particular topic or issue at that meeting, mm-hmm. council would respond one way or another.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
That has been our goal. Yep.
And that's something new.
Well, maybe some prior councils had done it, but there's no official way to do that. Mm-hmm. But this council has decided it's a priority of ours mm-hmm. to, you know, at least respond to everyone. So we are doing that now. Yeah. It's interesting in the council comments section, we can't deliberate much. That item wasn't posted as an agenda item, with, you know, the legal required notice. So we can't really debate the merit of it mm-hmm. much during council comments. We can just ask for more information, ask that maybe it be placed on a future agenda, but you won't see us debating that topic so soon. We have to put it on an agenda before we can actually debate the merit of a topic like that.
Mm-hmm. And who sets the agenda, and how can someone, a resident, get something on the agenda, or can they?
Yeah, so staff build the agenda, and to get something on it, you'd have to go through the process we just mentioned, where you have a topic in mind you'd like discussed on an agenda. You need to either send us an email about that topic, or come speak at public forum, or send us a letter. And then if we think that topic fits with our priorities as a city, then we might ask that topic be placed on a future agenda. I guess there's no guarantee you can get an item on mm-hmm. a future agenda, but that's how you try, yeah. Mm-hmm. Council might decide, depending on the item, that it is worth further study, or maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
And does that happen quite a bit, that people bring an idea forward and it gets taken up?
I would say, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. We get a number of communications every time we have a meeting, and sometimes even on the weeks we don't have a meeting, we get these packets of communications from citizens or businesses, or, you know, anyone can send a request. Yeah, and we refer a number of them, at least for more information, to staff. Probably keep mm-hmm. staff on their toes quite a bit with the amount we send through, actually. Yeah, so that is pretty much my little lesson in how to
okay.
get an item in
front of us. Is there going to be a quiz?
Yeah. You have to try to get
City
an ordinance
Council 101.
That's your task.
Okay.
So then I thought, yeah, I could talk a little bit about what's coming up
current
this month.
Issues.
Yep.
Okay.
And what we've recently
topics.
Talked about. A big one coming up in April is the rental housing, finalizing the rental
right.
housing concepts yeah. we've been working on. So we did recently pass the first reading of our rental code ordinance changes, but we do still have to talk about the concept of a potential rental percentage cap. And that discussion is coming up on the 10th, and then also the meeting on the 27th, I believe, relates to that as well, mm-hmm. both Tuesdays. I think those dates are right.
And that's a percentage cap for certain neighborhoods in the city, rental percentage cap.
Yeah. And what we really want to talk about on the 10th is we would love feedback from neighborhoods, both near campus and not, to see if we're setting the map right to start, in a sense. You know, are we going with the right neighborhoods? Are there other neighborhoods that would prefer a cap that aren't getting one? Or conversely, are there some that don't necessarily say they want one, you know, that we would be imposing one on? So we're interested really in hearing feedback from the neighborhoods.
Okay.
So that's coming up, and that's a big topic. Everybody's been watching that one closely. Another one we recently talked about is the what we call the Lincoln Way downtown gateway, mm-hmm. the concept of this area. And that came up at the last meeting. We heard from a developer who's interested in redeveloping that area between, I think, Clark and Kellogg there, north side of Lincoln Way, into a, it would be like an apartment and hotel type development in that area. And we directed staff to keep working with the developer on that. There were a number of things that we wanted to see tweaked in that plan, but they're going to keep working on it and bring us a more of a proposal back at some point in the future. So that one I know is one that people were really interested mm-hmm. in watching too.
Okay.
Let's see. What else have I got in my notes here?
We probably have time for one more thing.
Sure. Well, Ragbri, that's exciting. I'm excited about that one. We talked about that, too, at the last meeting. Ragbri will be coming to town on Tuesday, the 24th of July. And we expect a lot of people, you know, probably 25 to 30,000, mm-hmm. tens of thousands anyway. And the idea is they'll come into town. The route will bring them on South Dakota to Mortenson, to Beach, to Jack Trice Stadium, which would be the official welcome area. Okay. They would camp in Brookside and Stuart Smith Park, so the park that runs north to south there all along. And then hardtop surfaces be used for their other vehicles. But then downtown is poised to be the main entertainment area for the evening. So there'll be a lot of people around, mm-hmm. and I think it'll be fun. I like Ragbri a lot. I've done several. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to hosting and showing what Ames has to offer.
Okay. And so the city council is involved in getting the town ready for that.
Yeah. It was funny. ACVB, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, is working, to really organize, right. The Ragbri stay in Ames. And they had a number of suggestions of things that we'd have to look at in order for Ragbri to be successful here. They talked about right now we have ordinances that prohibit overnight stays in those parks. We'd have to at least allow it for one day there.
Amend those. Or, yeah. Okay.
There is actually an old law in the books, too, that prohibits riding your bike on hard surfaces in Brookside, which I don't think anyone realizes. There's a path that runs there.
Yeah, and people ride their bikes on it all the time.
Yep. So we need to change that one probably permanently.
But. Okay. All right. So just remind us when and where city council meetings are.
Oh, yep. So the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, sometimes more, at 6 p.m. in council chambers at City Hall.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would love to see anyone there.
Okay. And people can see specific agendas on the website?
Yep.
Agendas, in advance?
Yeah, agendas are on the website, and the meetings are video streamed on Channel 12 and on Facebook. You can watch record of the video, too, and jump to any agenda item you want to watch that record. So we try to make it easy on the website.
Easy for people to get involved.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Bronwyn, for coming in and educating us on this.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Bronwyn Beattie Hansen from Ames City Council.
When lonely feelings chill the meadows of your mind, just think when winter comes, can spring be far behind? Beneath the deepest snow, the secret of a rose is merely that it knows you must believe in spring. Just as a tree is sure its leaves will reappear, it knows its emptiness is just a time of year. The frozen mountains dream of April's melting streams. How crystal clear it seems.
You must. That was You Must Believe in Spring by Freddie Cole. A song to remind us that spring will come, despite what seems like its reluctance to appear. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI, and we now have Rose Green on the phone from Des Moines. Good morning, Rose.
Good morning, Gail.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak about our schools.
And Rose Green is with the organization called Parents for Great Iowa Schools. So let's start by, can you please tell us about your organization, how long it's existed, and what its goals are?
Sure, Gail. Great. So Parents for Great Iowa Schools really started out, as many, many movements do, just a bunch of parents starting to notice something and getting together and deciding to act. And so many years ago, it was really as it was local as we were just trying to figure out what was going on at our school and why we were losing teachers and programs. And it started out really as an effort to educate ourselves and and figure out what was going on with our funding formula, and we learned so much. And over the last year or so, and which is almost following a national trend, there was such a significant increase in the amount of interest in our grassroots movement. And it was really just a lot of parents. We are an all-volunteer, parent-led group, and it seemed people were coming out of the woodwork to support our Iowa public schools. So in turn, we were able to do a lot more over the last 2 years and create a Facebook page and monitor that on top of doing our work as parents and as professionals. And we've made a website, and we've really stepped up our advocacy at the state legislature, in turn because of those resources that our parents, our passionate parents, brought to us. And you ask about what is our goal and maybe what is our mission.
Mm-hmm.
And our mission is to, and we're certainly not an exclusive group, we know it's in our name that we're parents for Great Iowa Schools, but we engage with parents and grandparents and family members, community members, business owners, professionals, to show support for the great community schools that we care about and to really focus that engagement at the state legislature, because we've learned over the course of our couple of years in existence that the policies that are set at the state legislature when we're in session have a really great impact on how we operate as schools every day of the year.
So let's talk about some of those policies and issues in particular that are coming up with the current legislature that your group is focused on.
Great. Well, we focused, coming out of the gates, which is always a hard prediction to do in January.
Right. You don't know what's going to come up.
Trying to figure out what the legislature is going to focus on. And if I could say our top three going into the session were the funding formulas. It's called SSA, or Supplemental State Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, there's a lot of confusion around this, because when people look at their property tax bill, of course the largest amount of it is going to their community schools. But in the background, what really happens is that money goes to your county, and then it's combined with state monies. And the state ultimately pushes out the money to the local districts. And so that was our first, one of our top priorities. And then our second priority was the SAVE, which is a local option, is a sales tax, and it stands for Secure and Advanced Vision for Education, and it's really to keep funding for infrastructure and building improvements separate from what happens in the classroom. So that was our second priority. And then our third priority was this conversation that was growing, this momentum that was growing around education savings accounts, vouchers. They're all kind of the same mechanism where it diverts public money to private education versus how it's traditionally been, is just been taxpayer money has funded public education. So I can go into those three, Gail, but those were our top three priorities this year.
Okay, and those have been issues that have come up. So those were kind of your predictions of what was going to rise to the top, and is that, in fact, what has come up?
It has. And there's definitely been some that we did a tour over the start of the legislature where we went to about five different cities and talked to hundreds of parents. And we tested this. We said, well, this is what we're hearing. And we learned a little bit more, but you're right. We have focused on these three the most.
Okay. Well, maybe let's talk about the educational savings accounts, the ESAs, because that may be something that our listeners are less familiar with.
No, absolutely, and that is a very active issue right now, because it's had a committee meeting. It has not advanced any further, and we only have 2 weeks left for the session. So I don't think it's the last we've heard of it, but we really don't know. So I think it's really great to educate folks on that. Vouchers, they're being called education savings accounts. This is started with a bill introduced by Senator Shelgren in the Senate, and uniquely, it's gone through the Appropriations Subcommittee in the Senate versus the Education Subcommittee. And it basically is a bill that allows parents to choose to take a portion of, so the amount that that school districts receive for public school students is around $6,600 per year. And so they have taken a portion of that. They're saying around $4,000 a year, that a parent could take that in the form of a debit card or some form like that. and use that to pay for tuition at a private school. And those would be for, not for homeschool students, so they're excluded from that, but it would be for any child that has been in the public school for over a year and wanted to opt out and go to a private school, and including all incoming kindergartners as well. So they wouldn't have had to gone to a public school for a year. Kindergartners could come straight into that system.
And so that's being considered still. It still might come up for a vote. And
it is still active, yes.
Okay. So what do you see as the implications if something like that were passed for Iowa?
Well, my biggest concern, and being that I started the group and our group started being concerned about funding, because through the mid-1990s, the formula for school funding was it was a formula. It was based on economic indicators and needs. And so in the mid-1990s, we went to adjusting it based on political will and financial priorities. And if you can go to our website, and we have a chart of this, you can see the downward trend since we took that formula away and made it more up to the will of the legislature that year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had this downward trend in funding. And this year specifically, we have we saw a 1% increase in funding, which some could debate is a decrease in funding because if you consider just the inflationary costs of running a district,
right,
like health care and the costs of goods and services that we need to buy for our, to serve our students, some would say that's a negative increase. And so we work through that, you know, in the first 45 days of the legislature, and then to see that we're going to come up with an estimated, they're saying the estimates are around 14 to 15 million to fund this program. So to me, there is, it sounds like we don't have the money to fund the public schools at a level that is maybe above inflation, but we have the 15 million to cover these private school students. And even furthermore, you know, there's taxpayer money that's involved in these education savings accounts or vouchers. They all end up being the same thing. We call them different things, but the end is taking taxpayer money for private schooling. You know, our concern is the transparency isn't there. Over the summer, I tried to make a list of all the rules that public schools must go through and all the regulations and all the reports versus a private school, and it looked like Santa's world list. You know, all the children and all their wish lists. You know, it was my comparison for how long the rules were for public schools, and the transparency for the private schools that could receive this money is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And one example that always comes up is that that public schools don't choose the student. The student chooses the school, and we accept everyone. And public schools with taxpayer money can decide that a child can't come to that school because maybe they can't serve them. But we don't have that choice in the public schools. So there's that taxpayer accountability and transparency that wouldn't be there with that bill that really concerns me. And the other that concerns our group is that when you look at the six other states that have adopted education savings accounts, I think the highest ranking that they have is 29, and they go down into the high 40s of, you know, how their education system ranks,
mm-hmm.
you know, across the United States. And we're much higher than that in Iowa, and so I don't know why we would want to pursue a program that has not brought student achievement up in these other states. And last, I think we believe it leaves our rural students behind because there are many counties, we've estimated close to 80,000 public school students don't have a choice to take that voucher, that education savings account, and go to a private school. So all that money would be focused on, you know, some of our larger urban areas. We just feel it leaves children behind, and it doesn't support the public school system with integrity like we've done historically in Iowa.
And what kinds of responses have you been getting from the legislators when you bring up these concerns?
Well, we pride ourselves on trying to be fact-based and nonpartisan. And so, but it seems to me that this is a bit of a partisan issue at the legislature. And, you know, the folks that aren't the legislators that are in favor of it seem to really believe that parent choice is very important, and it's more important than anything else. And so that seems to be the root of the issue. And so when we talk about student achievement and we talk about some of these other concerns about, you know, public school funding and how we haven't maybe supported that with the integrity that our state has typically done that or historically, the conversation seems to really go back to, it's a parent's choice. And there just seems to be a lot of special interest in movement behind this voucher system, and it's more widely acceptable on the Republican side of the aisle than the Democratic side. And again, we don't want to focus on the part. We don't want to make public schools partisan. We don't see them as a partisan issue. We see them as a general welfare issue. But unfortunately, in our legislature, it seems to be quite a partisan issue.
So we've been talking about the ESAs, and we probably won't have time to talk about SSA and the SAVE and the penny sales tax. But people can get more information from your website and Facebook. Can you give us that information?
That would be so great. So our website is, you can Google Parents for Great Iowa Schools, or the web address is p4gis.org. And we also have a strong presence on Facebook, and we try and use a lot of visuals to explain what we're advocating for. And then on our website, you can sign up for our newsletter, and our newsletter is our main form of communication, that if we feel like there's a really urgent issue that supports our public schools and we're trying to engage people across the state, we'll send out a newsletter with all the information in there, and usually it includes an action alert, a very specific action that a parent or a community member can take to voice their opinion.
And we'll put a link to that website when we post today's show on KHOI's website.
Great.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Gail.
That was Rose Green from Parents for Great Iowa Schools.
Моя вот пойми фронта, земпурке вот отрубла, бока кометеж нера, не бока тава пас ментира, тут ни 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 тарто си, тач граса и коза си ми. Моя вот пойми фронта, земпурке вот отрубла, бока кометеж нера, не бока тава пас ментира, тут ни 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 тарто си, тач граса и коза си ми. Озиня, пара са луз бой френта, Ozinha, boca rouba, boca mata. Sempre na juventude, este problema te acontecer. Nininha de Nossa Senhora, e tu me crepeceu. Sempre na juventude, este problema te acontecer. Nininha de Nossa Senhora, e tu me crepeceu. Pai, vou enfrentar. Tem porquê botar trublar. Boca comete geneira. Nem boca tava pra sementeira. Pro nininha dar doce. Das graças e gozar seme, vai vou pai vou enfrentar, sem porquê vou te atrublar, boca comete geneira, nem boca tava pra sementeira, pro nininha estar doce, das graças e gozar seme.
This is Local Talk on KHOI. That was a song called Zinha by Cesaria Evora, a performer from Cape Verde. Now we've been joined by Lucia Suarez, an associate professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at ISU, and also the director of the U.S. Latino-Latina Studies Program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And this is your first time at the station because you're kind of new to Ames.
I am. I just arrived.
So welcome to KHOI.
Thank you.
And you just have come relatively recently to ISU. So tell us a bit about your academic career before arriving here.
So I am I'm Cuban American. And so my initial work was studying the Caribbean. My initial work was Caribbean women claiming their islands. So I was looking at women from the Caribbean who live in New York and Paris and London, and how through the art, their art as opera singers or as writers specifically, they claimed an identity that was always based on the Caribbean. And I have continued that kind of work, that work of how do we belong? How do we claim our identities? How do we develop a sense of identity based on where we come from, also where we are, and what, how we are seen by the world that we are occupying. And that's, you know, political, that's geographical, that's linguistic. After that, I wrote a book called Tears of Hispaniola, which looked very specifically at diaspora writers from Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And that book really looked at how writing is a political act, but also a redeeming, healing process. And it's all about human rights and civil rights. And continuing along those lines, I've been working on dance in Brazil for the past 10 years. And very, very similarly, I mean, you know, like my goals are to think about, explore and, you know, explain how the arts, literacy and literature are a major part of the way that we live in this world. So the humanities are, in effect, from my perspective, a foundational way of seeing and being. And I also work, you know, very, very connected to my initial work as a graduate student and my first book, Latino Lives. You know, what does it mean to write our lives? What does it mean to belong? So I've been thinking about the concept of belonging for Latinos in the United States and elsewhere.
Well, that's a very timely topic, and it's great that you're bringing that to ISU now and to Iowa. So tell us about the U.S. Latino-Latina Studies program that you direct. How long has it been in existence? What are your goals and vision for it?
So it was founded in 1994. So in about a year and a half, we'll be celebrating the 25th year anniversary of U.S. Latino-Latina Studies at ISU. It's a cross-disciplinary program that's housed at the Department of World Languages and Cultures. As a new director, I see myself as a facilitator for cross-campus and community team building that best serves all of our students. One of my aims is to nurture fruitful debates that encourage historically grounded knowledge and compassionate community building. I think that's really important at this moment in time. Mm-hmm. The program, as you know, as I see it, or the vision that I have for it, is to serve as a bridging hub that connects classes, service, and outreach opportunities across colleges, schools, and departments. I hope that through the collaborative work that we do, through the programming that we offer, the classes from different departments, the outreach and service component, that our students can discover a stimulating field of critical and academic research, that they could engage in an exciting platform on which to link different fields of study and become part of outreach community networks in which they grow to become outstanding, conscientious leaders in their respective careers. And it's like a lot, right? That's a big blurb. But how do we do that, right? So actively and effectively, we've brought in lecturers from, you know, nationally renowned lecturers, and we will be doing that every year. So for Latinx History Month, we always bring a lecturer through collaborations. Right now, if everybody or anybody is interested, they should look on the webpage. Okay. And the webpage has a section under students, and there are all kinds of exciting new things that we've been able to put together this year with great teamwork from all of our affiliate faculty. So we have new scholarships that we'll be offering. We have internships that we're connecting with the 4-H program and with the Office of Latino Studies in Des Moines. We have a new learning community, which I think is really exciting.
And that's for incoming students, is that correct?
Yes and no. Traditionally, it's for incoming students, but I actually hope that this learning community is more inclusive and expansive. So maybe sophomores who were in programs that didn't get to do this their first year, or transfer students or open option students. So this particular learning community connects our intro course, which is USLS 211, Introduction to Latino, Latina, Latinx Studies, with an English 250. So it's a collaboration between our program and the English department. And they have two peer mentors. So we have a peer mentorship opportunity for students who have already taken these courses. And the goal is to really connect students. And maybe often students fall through the cracks. And so I'm hoping that this picks up the new students, those students that fell through the cracks, or those students who didn't even know. The name of the learning community is HOLA, and that stands for Heritage of Latinx in the Americas. So anybody that's interested, I'm letting everybody know it's open for fall 2018.
And the USLS program, as it's abbreviated, it's not a major. Is it a minor?
So it is a cross-disciplinary minor.
All right.
It also can be set up as a cross-disciplinary major. I think that it depends on how the students want to combine. It's a kind of study that at an institution like ISU would work very well as a minor, because you're an engineer, mm-hmm. or you're in economics, or you're in design or journalism, and how best to be part of all the changes and shifts and politics that are going on in our nation today than to mm-hmm. be part of this program, which opens up the world of Latin American heritage populations. And that's not just one population, but it's different communities with even different languages and different dialects. People from Latin America speak Guarani, Aymara. They have different dialects from the Caribbean or from Mexico or from Argentina. Historically, if you come from Argentina, you're going to have a very different historical experience than if you come from the Dominican Republic or from Cuba. And so what do all of these people, these incredibly vast migrations, represent in the melting pot world of U.S. culture, the United States landscape? So that's all about diversity and inclusion, difference and similarity, representation, politics of identity. So if you're a design, or if you're in the school of journalism, having this background is mm-hmm. going to help you be a better journalist when you go into Detroit or Des Moines or New York City or East LA. You don't just show up saying, "Hi, I'm coming to get information." You actually have this, you know, grounding knowledge that's historical, that's personal. So I would say it's a great minor mm-hmm. to combine. But if you're a sociologist, it could also be a major. You could do this cross-disciplinary major, because the goal or the point of this program is that you're working with faculty across campus. So you might be working with someone in sociology or someone in psychology or in history. And we have affiliate faculty or core faculty in those departments. So it's all... For me, it's just grounding.
Yeah. And so you see this as something that's valuable, not just to students who do identify as Latino, Latina, or Latinx, but for other students as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just see this as an opportunity to connect, to bridge between people across the board.
And for people who are not students at ISU, they can still take advantage of some of the programming and lectures and other kinds of things that the program
absolutely. I mean, that's the goal. If I had a vision, it would be making this be part of the larger picture. And it's a welcoming, open space. So we have lectures that are open to the public and our community. Everybody's welcome. We have pizza lunches. And people are invited and welcome to say, "Hey, I want to do this. How can we make it happen?" So it's open to everybody. It should be a safe place. That's it. I mean, I hope that this program provides its students and people that are connected to the students a vibrant, safe space.
And let's just talk a few more minutes about your own work the research and writing that you've done. And I know from looking on some of your information online on the website that dance is a big part of the work that you've done. Can you talk a bit more about that?
It's, I would say, foundational for me. I mean, I see the world through dance, and I feel the world in terms of physicality and music. And I am in the middle of finishing up the proofs of a book that I've co-edited, and I can tell you about that, which is like, you know, okay. I've been working on this all weekend. It's called Dancing Bahia. And it looks at, it's divided into 8 chapters, and it's a collaboration. It's an international collaboration that started in Brazil when I was there doing research. And I work with 2 other colleagues, one from Brazil and one from she's in California. Dancing Bahia looks at what it means to dance, to study, to teach Afro-Brazilian dance, so it's, you know, it's very connected to the African diaspora, in terms of not only community building, but also social mobility and citizenship building. So each chapter, we have a different author or a different researcher looking at what dance has represented in their lives. Very similar to what I've done in the past with literature, with literacy. In other words, how do we become integrated? How do we become active participants? How do we bring communities out from the margins? And how do we encourage social mobility through an art form? So this particular book is looking at dance.
That sounds fascinating. It sounds like you should be a guest lecturer and talk more about that.
I would love to. I mean, you know, this is passion for me, so yeah, would love that.
Do you use any performance-based research techniques in gathering your data or presenting it?
So not in presenting it yet, although I do think about that all of the time.
Yeah.
Definitely in gathering it. I've, you know, I'm a participant observer, which means that I have taken classes with different companies. I have, filmed the companies. I have filmed, the directors and the dancers themselves. So there's a certain level of participation, but I have tried to always keep it more, as I was trained in cultural studies. So I've always tried to keep it more in the side of the academic. But, you know, as I get older and kind of have a distance, I realize that, you know, the world wants more than just a straight up academic paper.
Yeah.
So I am really thinking seriously of combining, but that's kind of in the
other
works.
Ways of constructing and representing that knowledge.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's just finish up by one last question. Why is it significant, do you think, that ISU has a U.S. Latino, Latina, Latinx studies program?
Oh, that's a question. That's a loaded question on many levels. So for starters, the Midwest has a growing Latino population. Iowa has a population that, you know, the Latino population is young. So they're mostly in K-12 schools. Mm-hmm. But those people, we hope, will be getting their college degrees and coming to ISU. So it's significant on many levels. It's significant for what we can provide to our communities, how we can extend an outreach to K-12, the classes, the students, the teachers. But at some point, we're going to have students that want to have more people like them. So as a growing population of Latin American heritage students join the institution, there have to be places for them to belong, right? So the Latino Latinx Studies program is critical at this moment because of the growing populations, but also because of the media. The media represents Latin American heritage people in a very constricted manner. Mm-hmm. And it's, I would say, if it were true, it would be like 1% true, maybe, and that's true of any and all populations. But what is even more true is that Latin American heritage people do come from many different countries, different languages, different social scenarios, different economic scenarios. And so a place like Latin America, Latino-Latina Studies program is a place to like really engage history, really understand diversity, and really come to this deeply informed space of understanding how complex the United States is and how important each person in it is. There's enormous amount of valuation that a place like the USLS program can just highlight.
Well, thank you for coming in this morning and sharing a bit about your work and the program with us. We'll put links to that on our website.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Lucia Suarez, the director of the U.S. Latino-Latina Studies Program. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to it on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. You also heard Traces of You by Anushka Shankar and Nora Jones, You Must Believe in Spring by Freddie Cole, and Zinha by Cesaria Evora. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show, so you can get involved by contacting us at the station. Remember to stay tuned to KHOI for Democracy Now! And national news headlines from Pacifica Radio. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.